Good afternoon. So last time we started our little unit on some web security topics. We did what I hope was sort of kind of review of 3710 stuff about cross-site request forgery, and then a little about cross-site scripting. So we mentioned cross-site request forgery was this idea that, well, you know, our browser, when it makes requests to web pages, it sends the credentials for that web page, usually in the form of cookies. And it doesn't really usually care that other websites may have initiated that request. And we also talked about cross-site scripting, where the idea was, well, you know, we have web pages, which are kind of like computer programs, and often we take input from untrusted sources, put them in those computer programs, and sometimes that results in them being able to execute code instead of just like fill in a field. And we talked about, for cross-site scripting, kind of, you know, ways of detecting it and then ways of either preventing it or making it less bad when it happens. And for detecting it, we talked about, well, one thing we can do is we can try to analyze the program. We can kind of do this by hand. We can say, okay, this input, how do we make sure that if it ever appears in a web page, it appears in a safe way? And we mentioned that you could kind of do this very systematically, where we do some program analysis that's similar in style to that symbolic execution stuff, but we went to deal with strings and try to like solve for, is there a way that the input could turn into a, have a script, result in a script tag that wasn't there before or something like that. But probably from a more practical perspective, what do we do to detect this? We often just try inputs and see if they result in scripts running. And to do this, we want to provide some input which will produce some script running in a lot of contexts, because a challenge with just generically testing cross-site scripting is that we have to deal with, well, you know, the reason why this doesn't run scripts all the time is probably that it's in quotes or in a tag, and we need to do some work to break out of those quotes or tags and so on and into a context where we can run scripts. And what that exactly looks like depends on where the untrusted input actually ends up in the web page. So then we talked about these cross-site scripting fixes and mitigations. Like, the fix is we filter things properly. That's what we want our things to do. Another fix, which we'll talk a little about more today, is we host things we don't trust on a different domain. Right. We don't have to worry about having access to cookies, because web browsers kind of implicitly are designed that when I'm going to foo.com, it doesn't see bar.com stuff generally. We talked about last time about some sort of ways of making cross-site scripting type problems less bad. So one of these was web application firewalls that, you know, if we've installed some web apps and we think there might be some problems with them, we can install a filter in front of them that looks for things that look like cross-site scripting attacks and either disallows those requests or at least like lets us know, hey, something's going on here that's interesting. And we also talked about content security policy, which is a mechanism that browsers provide where websites can say, I don't like the default policy that my websites can include content from everywhere and connect to every other website. I want to limit that because I know what's supposed to happen, and this can make it a lot more difficult to use the vulnerability of cross-site scripting to actually do something useful. Since we mentioned kind of the useful thing an attacker wants to do to them is usually access the web page with the credentials of that user and either get information out or make changes, and that can be harder to do if we limit that access. So questions about these things we covered last time? Okay. So let's Yeah, last time we were talking about content security policy, we mentioned the idea of nonces and report only. And one thing I'd like to say about content security policy is that like I kind of started at attacking this idea of, you know, anti-cross-site scripting, but it's since it kind of expanded to kind of support two other major areas. So one is that it's also kind of the most modern mechanism for getting precise control over what websites can embed your website. And for why would we be concerned about this? Talk about, you know, there's something called clickjacking for which I have a demo set up. So if I do this and go, I do this and go over here and carefully see where I put my demo, which I conveniently put on the wrong screen. Ah, yes. So we have this clickjacking demo here. And sort of a thing we can do if we aren't careful about it. Let me see what's happening. Is here, I have a frame of a website, which is, I have a frame of this page here. Right, so I can load this page separately, but I can also have another website embed it. And when I've embedded it, I've set some style in here where I said, you know, we're going to put this such that it's in front. That's what the Z index field in CSS does. And we're going to move it up above the iframe tag by a little bit and just have it be floating there. And so my sort of other web page here is sitting in front of this link. Doesn't look like it's sitting in front of this link, and it's transparent. And, well, I made it transparent so we can see what was going on, and I did that by just setting the opacity to 50%, 0.5, but I could actually set it to 0. And so I have this link here, and when I click this link, I'm actually clicking a button that we can't see. So this is what's called a clickjacking attack. And this is a reason why we might want to kind of limit our ability of web pages to embed other web pages. And why this is kind of frequently restricted. And content security policy actually wasn't the first thing to support limiting this. There's a more older thing that's more commonly used of X-frame options header that allows you to control how things are embedded within other web pages. But you can see that this is kind of necessary for sort of controlling that access. There are other things which also can make this not work kind of accidentally. So I don't know if we'll have time to talk about it, but in this case, for this to, you know, actually be an attack, it needs to be the case that when I embed the web page, it sends the cookies for me being logged into the other thing. And some web browsers kind of don't enable that. And one of the main reasons they do that is to avoid tracking, not for this security reason. Okay, so that's, you know, honestly, yes, content security policy. So as for content security policy, so this idea has been around for a while. People have looked at how it's used, and you know, it provides this idea that we can kind of filter out scripts, you know, and make it so, you know, most cross-site scripting bugs will be a lot harder to exploit in a useful way. But a lot of websites don't really use good policy. So CSP was made around 2014, you know, and this paper analyzed the deployment between 2014 and 2019, you know, on like top 1,000, 10,000 websites, something like that. And they found that even though there were rules about access to scripts, that very often people had these policies that essentially just allowed, you know, didn't actually mitigate meaningfully against cross-site scripting bugs. You know, so they're allowing unsafe inline. You know, that's the main thing we were hoping we'd prevent. That's just allowed. The other thing is that this content security policies, we saw in our example at the end of last time that, you know, they can get quite complicated. And the implementation of them from the browser side is also an area where there's a lot of workplaces that browsers have to make sure they're checking. And there have been bugs, you know, a lot of bugs that either result in kind of information leaks from websites or, you know, where the CS content security policy rules aren't actually enforced the way you want them to be. And very often, this paper looked at these bugs and also looked at, well, what were the patches that introduced the bugs actually doing? In a lot of the cases, the first implementation of the feature, they missed a case. Oops. But also, like, those other changes often accidentally end up kind of missing. Oh, we need to make sure that this thing we're loading actually matches the content security policy. You know, that sort of thing often gets missed. Okay, so one more thing about cross-site scripting. Go back to what I suggested is this first solution to avoiding cross-site scripting, which is that let's just not host the dangerous input on the same domain that we used originally. And the reason for this is that dealing with kind of just a user file is actually especially tricky. Because if you actually look at what, say, GitHub or Google or probably most major places do for hosting kind of user images and things like that, they usually make a separate domain to host them. And the reason is that there have historically been some major issues with how browsers deal with kind of just full files that are user content. So let's say I have a website with profile pictures, and I allow users to upload profile pictures. Very nice. So I, as a malicious user, I'm going to upload this profile picture. This is my profilepic.png. Doesn't look like a PNG file, but sure, I can rename it that and upload it. And it's kind of really annoying to write code to make sure the profile picture is actually a PNG, so you probably wouldn't. And then what do I do? Well, I just embed the website I uploaded to it, embed the profile picture in the place where we'd expect an HTML file. And the problem here is that now it seems like if my web browser loads this embedded iframe, it's going to try to load an HTML file, and it gets this HTML file here that contains scripts. And this is like a really bad cross-site scripting bug. I can just put whatever scripts I want. No real work. So questions about this kind of attack setup? So some of you who know something about the web might see a reason why this shouldn't work. Can someone tell me any reason, people who've seen things, you doing stuff with websites, a reason why you think this might not, shouldn't work? Yeah.
Wait, never mind. I thought I saw it, but I don't.
This is not something on the slide. This is like something that you might know if you've written a web application that you had to do, that you might think, well, that should make this not work. So if we think of, like, let's consider the legitimate case here. If I have an image tag with the that points to get picture, the browser needs to know, like, what kind of image that is. And usually, if you've written web applications, you say, okay, well, that means that I'm going to send the browser information about the kind of image. We could imagine maybe the browser will figure it out itself. But usually, we'd send information about the kind of image. And if you look at typical HTTP response headers, they'll include a content type to tell the browser this information. So if we didn't send that, yeah, we have a huge problem. But if you've made web applications before, you'll often find that your application's kind of broken if you forget to send this. Not always broken, but kind of broken. And so you might say, okay, so we're going to send this. This is an image PNG, and therefore the web browser is going to not try to interpret it as an HTML file, and it's going to display it in the frame as a PNG and fail to load it and say, too bad. That's what we expect to happen. So unfortunately, as we're seeing as a theme here, the web browser behavior was chosen at a time when we didn't think of the security implications of a bunch of things. We've seen this already with clickjacking attacks, right? We didn't think about the security implications of allowing embedding web pages, and we kind of have to still allow that to not break web pages. And here we have a similar issue, which is that we have this idea that we're supposed to send these content types, and as long as we send them, we should be okay, because the web browser knows what the data is. The problem is that in the history of the web, there were some web servers that always sent the wrong content type, and browsers had some options of how they could deal with this. One option would be that we just make those websites not work. That's not the option they chose. They said, well, We should make this website work, and they decided to do that. Any browsers? I guess this is probably historically, I hope. I'm not sure, but I think, but this used to be a huge problem. And in particular, it used to be the case that old Internet Explorer was the most aggressive about this, meaning your website worked the most often in Internet Explorer. This is a feature. And it would say, oh, well, this says image PNG, but it's definitely HTML. And right, it's pretty obvious it's HTML. It starts with doctype HTML. And it would helpfully interpret it as HTML. And most browsers didn't go to so extreme as interpreting image as HTML, but they'd often interpret text plain as HTML because that was a common way web servers were broken. So there's been some modern effort to fix this, and the big thing is that some browser makers got together and wrote, this is how you're allowed to guess content types. And there's kind of two features here, one of which came before this standard, but is now kind of documented more officially. There's this header you can add, which says, hey, I'm sending you a content type, don't second guess it. Just break my web page instead. And also, the people writing these rules have maybe been more careful about allowing kind of things to upgrade to what they call scriptable content types, things like HTML, which can contain scripts. So they just say that usually we don't allow things to go up to be inferred as one of those types, even if it would otherwise, except in, for going from something that's clearly not, doesn't allow scripts like TextPlain. So we talked about embedding web pages and other web pages, and we mentioned kind of the clickjacking issue. And this was a way around kind of the normal restrictions on embedding. So on the course website, for example, we have a calendar served by Google embedded in a website served by cs.virginia.edu. So we saw we could do some things with clickjacking, and we had this defense of sort of limiting when it's allowed. But we also have features where, we can often just, read data from a website. So let's look at what that looks like. Here, I have this demo. So I have a website which says the secret code is over here. And if I look at the source here, I'm loading local secret, and this read local secret function is using this iframe to access something from another web page. And so, if I click read local secrets, I did this from the wrong place. Okay. If I click read local secret and this is served on an HTTPS website, which would be this one. So if I am looking at this on an HTTPS website and I click read local secret, you see I can get that value. It doesn't work on my local file system because there's a special rule we can talk about later. So I can try to read the Canvas website, but Canvas has set up one of those headers we talked about that prohibits accessing. So if we look at the headers, we see that there's this content security policy with frame ancestor self. So I can't embed canvas.its.virginia.edu on my other websites. So here I have a remote website that's embedded. So I'm embedding this demo app web page, and I'm trying to do the same thing. I'm just trying to access the secret element and get its contents. And when I do that here, we'll look at the bottom of our console. We'll see that it says, in read remote secret, you got a null. So what's going on there is that the web browser actually cares about whether we're coming from the right web page. This one. So we saw we get this error where the web browser somehow knows when to deny access and when not to. And it has some situations in which it does and some in which it doesn't. And the rule for this is something called the same origin policy. So, the idea is we want to support loading content dynamically, but we don't just want you to be able to load any website and access it. And You know, we want to support lots of fancy loading content. Like if you think of Google Docs, we want to like load changes to the document as it's happening, you know, in the same website. We want to have let scripts actually load lots of things. But we don't want to let you do this for another website. So the same origin policy basically says if two scripts are from the same origin, we'll talk about exactly what that means later, then the scripts can pretty much do anything. But if the two pages are from different origins, basically all the information from the other origin won't be available. And this is something the browser is supposed to enforce, and is kind of the primary security mechanism that scripting has on websites to like keep information, you know, keep a one website from getting all your information. So what's an origin? An origin is basically the part of the URL up to the server name with an asterisk here. So this depends on the browser. For the file URLs in Firefox and Chromium, at least, it's sort of all file URLs have different origins. I'm not sure if all, at least currently, this maybe didn't used to be the case, and that's why my attempt to run that demo locally didn't work. Because my other website, even though it was in the same directory, it said, oh, that's a different origin. So the same origin policy is a reason why, you know, you don't want to try to share a domain name with between different sort of content. So in addition to the content type issue we talked about, this is another reason why you might want to host dangerous stuff on another domain name. Because the same origin policy will limit what that can do if scripts can run. And you're just in huge trouble if they get any web page, anything on the same domain, or anything with the same origin. And from a practical point of view, if you know how HTTP works, you'll know that in kind of the modern version of it, you can actually have one server host multiple names. And it's the names that are isolated, not the servers. So that's a way you can get kind of separate websites as far as the browser's protections are concerned. So as far as examples of things going wrong with the same origin policy, example, one case where this comes up, has come up a bunch, and hopefully is now more regular, is with not with normal web browsers, but with web browsers embedded in other applications. Right, that we want these rules enforced, and this is kind of important if we think about what the impact of cross-site scripting can be. And iMessage briefly had a bug where they had a cross-site scripting vulnerability in iMessage, and iMessage used an embedded browser to display messages. And this was much worse than it needed to be because the embedded browser didn't meaningfully enforce the same origin policy, unlike a normal browser. So how this worked is that, well, they did some checking of links. And I had mentioned last time that we can have links that run JavaScript, that are JavaScript calling. And they didn't make it super easy. They just required that links had a :// And this actually makes it a little non-trivial to run JavaScript, because if you just put JavaScript code after that, that's a JavaScript comment after the colon. But the fix is that we can specify a new line there, and that starts a new line of JavaScript, and that just worked. And because we weren't enforcing the same origin policy, this script could request a file like this, the iMessage chat database. I think they couldn't just request any file because OS X did application sandboxing. So this is an example where sandboxing made this a lot less bad than it could have otherwise been. So they couldn't read every file in the system, but they could read the files iMessage legitimately had access to, like the message database. But let's talk, so that's an example of the same origin policy. Let's talk about kind of the edges of the same origin policy. So the same origin policy, you know, has some things that you definitely need the same origin for. So accessing web pages you load in an iframe or a pop-up window, you can't do that from scripts if they aren't from the same origin as you. And doing the inverse, that if you're loaded in an iframe, you can't access the thing loading you unless you're from the same origin. And also sending certain times of HTTP requests. Basically, the history is that originally, no one cared about the same origin policy. Then, when we were doing more scripting, we realized we need to start thinking about security. So the types of requests invented when people started thinking about security, those have these restrictions. The older types don't. And so this means that a lot of things that are kind of historical don't have any same origin restrictions, even though you might think they should. So we saw one example of this earlier with CSRF, right? Cross-site submitting forms to another website, there's no restrictions, just allowed. Because that was an old thing, people weren't thinking about this problem. And some of these might make sense, right? Linking kind of makes sense that we want to allow that. Something we can give, something with explicit permission, we want to allow that. And this, you know, maybe that's a more complicated question, right? Should we allow you to put a web page in an iframe just without permission of the other web page by default, which is, you know, was the default. You might notice there's a little bit of a tricky thing here, which is that we can not get syntax errors for scripts, and this is something that's done because of the issue of loading something that's not supposed to be a script as a script, and getting information out of that that we're not supposed to be able to read by interpreting the syntax error. So at some, originally they got let you get and then really, wait a moment, this lets people get like, people load like a text file and sometimes the JavaScript parser will say, oh, I don't recognize what password equals foo is. That's a syntax error and that would be really bad. So one of these things that's allowed is loading like images, style sheets, video, audio. Like this kind of history of the web is that we have never actually kind of had default restrictions on cross-site loading of these resources. And this kind of sometimes results in some weirdness. Let's take an example. So Facebook, at least historically, and it seems like they still do when I checked, has this page you can point to that redirects, that shows a login prompt, and then after the login redirects you to a specified URL. And if you're already logged in, it just goes to that URL. So here's an interesting image URL that the image is the login redirect and then pointing to an actual image that's on facebook.com, so they won't blanket you redirect to it. then this image will either load a login form, which is not going to be a valid image, or it will load a valid image. And we're allowed to learn things about images loading successfully or not, and also their size. So assuming that the web browser sends our cookies to Facebook when it asks for login.php here, this will tell us if the user is logged in. And it used to be the case that this was kind of the default. It would always just, you know, send your credentials. This has changed over the past while as we've gotten a little more sensitive about privacy. So some browsers definitely disallow this. I'm not sure if the combination of Chrome and how Facebook currently sets up their cookies disallows it. But Firefox and Safari definitely disallow, don't send the cookies, so this doesn't work anymore, but it definitely used to, and probably still does in a bunch of cases where we aren't prohibiting cookies from being sent, which is not a security measure, it's a privacy measure. And you can think of this type of thing like it's probably a pretty big unintentional information leak, because we allow loading images, and because even though we can't read the image, we can learn about whether the image loads successfully. Yeah?
So if you have a website that's not Facebook, you try to load the Facebook logo with this URL. If that URL loads, then we can apply the user is on this browser logged in Facebook.
Yes.
If it crashes, they're not.
So if this URL loads, we know that the user is logged in. If it doesn't load, either they're not logged in, or their browser and or Facebook have privacy protections that don't send their credentials in an embedded request. Or Facebook set up a content security policy, something like that. Is that your question? So the other kind of thing, leak that this can give us is, let's say I have some service.com that has loads an icon when the search next to each search result. We have a little icon. So what we can do is we can search for something there, and we never see the results page. We're just modifying an iframe to point to it, so it's loaded in an embedded thing. And after it's loaded, we load that icon. And we just check, how fast did this icon load? And if it loaded quickly, it was probably cached. And if it loaded slowly, it probably wasn't. So this is another sort of information leak. This is something that kind of browsers, if you look, have been kind of attacking in kind of two different ways. So one way is that this performance.now function is more limited as far as its precision when you're allowed to load things from other origins in most browsers these days. This is mostly actually because of Spectre type attacks, but it also applies to this sort of thing. But probably this is still doable if the image loads slowly enough, quote unquote, normally. So I mentioned my third-party cookie thing. So one of the big, so besides privacy changes for third-party cookies, another change that kind of affects this is that cookies have this attribute that you can now set called same site. And you can opt into, hey, please don't send these cookies when someone's like embedding an image from another website or something. So if you set same site equals strict, the cookies just won't be sent when the request in any way comes from a different website. And for the most part, it seems like most browsers are defaulting to this new LAX policy, where image requests now, by default, don't send the cookies unless you explicitly mark the cookie as same site equals none, saying, yes, I want this cookie sent for embedded images. But this took a long time to happen. You know, historically, you know, the default was essentially the same as same site equals none. The cookies would always be sent. But this is probably the big thing that keeps that Facebook attack from actually working anymore, is that Facebook cookies now default, cookies in general now default not to being sent in those contexts, whereas they used to be. But you can still learn whether the image loads or not and all that, but still cross-site information. Okay, so we talked about these kind of information leaks that are unintentional, but often we want to send information intentionally between websites, right? So we talked about like Facebook unintentionally telling us whether people were logged in, but like Facebook has like login with Facebook. Like, how do we make that work if we can't actually sort of send things to other websites? And we actually don't need to change. So there are mechanisms for sort of making exceptions to the same origin policy on request, which we'll talk about in a bit, but we don't actually need those. So something we can do is we can have, say, example.com can redirect at the top level, so it's not an embedded resource. We don't actually have any weird cookie restrictions to our, say, social network site. And then it can redirect back to example.com with some token in the URL or in a post request. And that token can pass the information to prove to example.com this is a genuine login. And note that there's no same origin policy issues here. We aren't reading stuff from socialnetwork.com. We're getting redirected with something in the URL. So that solves that. But also, there's some cases where this kind of really isn't viable, where we want to have kind of information retrieved from JavaScript on the website in a way that this, like, this strategy of let's redirect back and go there wouldn't allow. Like, if we think of, like, you know, providing an API to translate things on a website, kind of wouldn't be nice if we had to redirect the whole browser to a new web, to Google and then back. So there's an explicit mechanism where web pages can say opt in to allowing cross-origin requests and allowing them to be run. And this is these days defined in the fetch standard, which actually defines kind of the modern procedures for browsers used to get anything from a web page, how they do it, and so on. And the fetch standard kind of divides requests into four different types with very different security rules. So we have our navigate request, which is I'm taking the whole web page to a different one. So this is kind of a fresh request in some sense, even though it might be the result of redirecting the whole website. We have our old default, which are labeled as no cores. They're not using this thing we'll call cross-origin resource sharing. And these have limitations on kind of how information is made available to scripts. So we saw, like, when I embedded an iframe, I couldn't read any of it. That's because it was requested with this kind of old default here. And then we have sort of separate categories for the remote server tells us explicitly this request is allowed from different origins or it's from the same web page. And we can actually request specific types of requests to be made when we're embedding scripts and images. So I mentioned the default is this kind of old thing where we don't allow thing, but we can request that we make a request using this mechanism where the foreign website opts in to allowing a cross-origin request. And we can actually specify, do I want to send cookies when we do that? Now, an issue you might have here is that you might say, if it's supposed to opt in, if you know how HTTP works, you might know the way it works is our browser connects to a server, requests something, and the server sends it back. And this doesn't seem to allow opt-in because I've made the request already. If my server doesn't know about this way of opting in and has not decided to, then it's too late. And the solution for this is that we will make a pre-flight request. So this is for options and the URL. So this is an example from the 3130 quiz site. We actually send a cross-origin request for reasons of not having it work when you're logged out of NetBatch by accident. But we need a pre-flight request. So before the browser sends the real request, which in this case is a post, it sends this options request saying, is this okay for me to do? And we have this response here that says, yes, it's okay if you're coming from the origin kytos.cs.virginia.edu. And there's a bunch of these headers that the sort of server can set to say, hey, I'd like you to allow scripts on this web page to access things and to send requests of this type and not others. But as I said, this is only done for kind of newer requests, so that like historical images and sort of quote-unquote normal iframes, just ignore these because they didn't exist 20 years ago. And those features are over 20 years old. So, and we didn't want to break websites, so we didn't. There's only a very few cases where we've broken websites, and they're things like rules about when cookies are sent on embedded requests, where we decided it's worth breaking websites for that. Okay, so I guess that's, I probably should consider myself out of time. I have some slides talking a little about user tracking. I'll just mention, like, the brief summary is, like, we mentioned about, like, sending cookies in these embedded requests. Like, this is, like, simultaneously an unintended sharing issue, but also this is something that browsers restrict for privacy reasons, that, you know, if Facebook might opt in to having the cookies always sent because that lets them learn all the websites I visit that embed something from Facebook. And browsers have decided that that's not okay. You know, some browsers have decided that that's not okay, not all of them. And try to restrict that. And also, you know, if you think about what we did here, as far as Facebook learning what websites are on, if this technique works for login, it could work for just learning what websites you're visiting. So, you know, that's kind of a way that this same origin idea is connected, is that if we can make exceptions, well, those exceptions often are used for things we want, but they're also kind of the same mechanisms used for what are the biggest privacy concerns people have online of major parties learning kind of all the websites you visit, you know, by deliberately going around the same origin policy, often with the permission of the people who operate those other websites. So that's where we'll, you know, today. So next time I'm gonna do exam review, so please come with questions. Or if you don't, I won't answer anything, so.